Alligators eating marshmallows, birds on bicycles, a mountain made of sand. You guessed it, we're going to some of Florida's roadside attractions, past and present. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at BayCareEvents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sessingham. Long before Florida was known for Mickey Mouse, it was a vacation destination defined by its beaches and other attractions that drew on the state's natural beauty. Spots like Silver Springs and Cypress Gardens and a variety of places that put the word gator in their names. One of the oldest continuously operated attractions in Florida is an 11-acre oasis just minutes away from a busy strip mall. At Sarasota Jungle Gardens, visitors can feed flamingos, stroll under a canopy of lush foliage, and even see a unicycle-riding cockatoo. Florida Matters' Kathy Carter takes us there.
As dozens of people file into a small amphitheater, various macaws and parrots are doing their best to warm up the crowd for the daily Jungle Bird Show. Animal shows are a staple at Sarasota Jungle Gardens, which opened to the public back on New Year's Eve, 1939. At the time, people came to see the exotic plants like the Australian nut trees, royal palms, and Peruvian apple cactus. The birds were introduced in the early 70s, and the first flock were a bunch of jailbirds. Literally. The garden's general manager, Chris Lavick, says the flock arrived from San Quentin Prison.
And they were trained by the prisoners to do these different tricks, including riding a bicycle and painting. And it was good therapy, you know, obviously for the prisoners. And the birds end up entertaining people for years after that.
And one of the birds is something of a celebrity. Frosty the unicycle riding cockatoo was once a frequent guest on the Ed Sullivan Show. The now 80-year-old bird is still pedaling and he's also pretty good on the scooter. The gardens are also home to Mac, a cobalt blue macaw whose eyes are rimmed in a very complimentary shade of corn yellow. And then there's Fortune, a small African gray parrot. Zookeeper Ricardo Corelli swears she's typically very chatty. Mostly, she brags. Her favorite sentence is, "I'm a pretty bird." She was a bit mum when we visited, but Ricardo says she's also apparently quite the joker.
The funny thing about her is that she has a sense of humor. Sometimes you ask her to do something that she knows how to do. For example, I ask her to say, "What does the dog say?" And then she'll give me a raspberry, like, and she'll do that, and then you go, "Missy," and then she'll laugh, ha 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 ha.
And Corelli says these birds aren't just entertaining. They're pretty smart, too.
It's been estimated that these guys have the intelligence of about a 3-year-old child. The African gray, Fortune, she can actually go up to a 5-year-old child. And they also have the same emotional range of those kids because they sometimes have tantrums and things like that, so just like any child. So in order to keep these guys, have to be prepared to have a 3-year-old child for 80 years.
Farther down a crushed shell walking path, past the butterfly garden, is perhaps Sarasota Jungle Garden's most iconic feature. A flamboyance of free-roaming flamingos that GM Chris Lavick says are not above cozying up to visitors offering snacks.
And because they're used to the human interaction, they're not afraid of humans. That's not their normal behavior. I don't know of anywhere where you can actually just stand right next to a flamingo and these guys don't care, as long as you got some pellets with you to feed them.
Lavick says these kinds of animal interactions used to be a mainstay of old Florida attractions. You can still get close to wildlife at some of the big theme parks, but those add-ons will cost you. Here, it's just the price of an admission ticket.
People can hold python snakes, they can hold parrots, they can pet a flamingo, hold an alligator. They're very unique experiences that represent Florida, I think, and especially with the old Florida attractions that used to do a lot of this stuff, and we're one of the few that do it still.
And that could be because Sarasota Jungle Gardens is a family business. It was purchased in 1971 by Arthur C. Allen, a one-time owner of the Chicago White Sox, a team that held spring training at Payne Park in Sarasota. His daughter, Dorothy Tinney, and her family operate the gardens today. They say they're committed to keeping the park's nostalgic nature.
That's kind of gone by the wayside now and given way to attractions that have a lot of rides. But I think a lot of people miss that old Florida, just being able to walk through a park without all the crowds, and at the same time learn about animals and plants, and it's just a laid-back setting.
And at the end of a winding trail, tucked away in a corner, you'll find Aldabra tortoises, Roscoe and Bertha. Aldabras are among the longest-living animals on the planet. Roscoe is pushing 100, and that's not much older than the gardens themselves, making Sarasota Jungle Gardens an oasis of time, far removed from the modern conveniences, like the cell phone store and the quick stop on Tamiami Trail, just a block away. For Florida Matters, I'm Kathy Carter.
Florida's history is intertwined with the story of tourism, and that started long before Walt Disney opened his Magic Kingdom in Orlando in 1971. Florida Matters' Mary Shedden spoke with historian Jim Schnurr, who oversees special collections at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg's Nelson Pointer Library.
The story of tourism in Florida, really until the 1970s, until air conditioning becomes more common, until Disney World opens up, focuses on the natural environment. So you would take paddleboat rides or ship rides down the St. John's River. You would sail along the coast area. You'd go out and fight mosquitoes as you enjoyed the natural environment. You'd go to Claremont and go up to the citrus tower and see orange trees. Oranges aren't native to Florida, but by the time that the citrus industry really had a strong hold on Florida, that's what you would do. So your interaction with tourism was often an interaction with the natural environment of Florida. The first milestone is when transportation becomes more available in the 1880s, 1890s, people start to come. By 1898, the United States gets involved with a war with Spain. That same transportation network brings down a different type of tourist, which is very important. Soldiers who fought during that brief campaign in 1898 to help liberate Cuba. The experience there in the Tampa Bay area is going to replay in smaller ways during the First and Second World War exponentially. Florida is transformed by World War II. People come to the military bases as young folks, training to go off to fight in war. Some of them love it so much that they will ultimately move down here, but in the interim, at least, they're coming down to enjoy the beaches. Another important thing, the automobile. So the state roads, the state road networks, county road networks, all this is part of a movement nationally to create a more unified transportation system. Tourism can take off exponentially when you have good roads and all these other systems in place.
You were talking about those early attractions and connecting to nature. I started thinking about a place like Sulphur Springs or Silver Springs or perhaps even Safety Harbor. Really, were people traveling from up north to come to these places?
Today, when you're driving on I-275, tour from the USF campus, once you get on or off Fowler, you drive over this little exit by Bird Street that says Sulphur Springs, and people think, oh, there's a water tower there, and there used to be something there. That something that was there 100 years ago was a very popular destination. Safety Harbor was an area, which today, you go to the downtown, the heart of Safety Harbor, and you still have the springs there and the recreational spa that's there. People didn't come here to ride on roller coasters. They came here in late 19th and early 20th century for health reasons. Once they came here, and they made transformations of the landscape, communities developed. Others want to come down as well.
Let's talk about some of the places that maybe folks see today or maybe aren't around anymore. I want to mention a few that folks might be familiar with. Spook Hill in Lake Wales, the Bock Tower, another one in Polk County. What are some of the places that were such a big part of what Florida attractions meant?
Some people have said that the real tourist enterprise doesn't really take off until the creation of Bock Tower. So what happens between 1929 and 1971, between the opening of Bock Tower and the opening of Walt Disney World, is that you have a number of roadside attractions that are along some of the new roads that the Good Roads Movement brings. Spook Hill is a great example by Lake Wales in that you have a car that you get to a certain line, you hit it neutral, and even though you're going down, you think you're going up. But think about that today in terms of if you were to take your kids, they would yawn or they'd be too busy texting in the back seat while you were at Spook Hill. They want to go on a roller coaster. Some of these attractions were amazing. Ones in the Tampa Bay area that we think about include ones like Bock Tower, but also a little closer to the general Tampa Bay area, Hillsborough River State Park, which during the Depression era and the New Deal years became a very important tourist destination. You have, of course, Sunken Gardens in St. Petersburg. Some of these roadside attractions still exist today. Some of them no longer do. In fact, many of them have gone out of business.
Jim Schnurr, thank you so much for taking us on a trip from the past to the present.
My pleasure. Thank you.
About an hour north of Tampa, at the crossroads of U.S. 19 and State Road 50, Weekiwachee is more than just a mark on a road map. The state park is one of Florida's oldest roadside attractions and features a spring-fed water park and wildlife show. It also brings to life a certain mythological creature that lures visitors into the cool blue spring waters. Florida Matters' Daylena Miller takes us to the home of Florida's famous mermaids.
Since 1947, Weekiwachee Springs has enchanted visitors young and old with an underwater exhibition that brings every little girl's fantasy to reality, the Mermaid Show.
I'm a mermaid at Weekiwachee Springs.
That's Taylor Kane, a marine biology student at the University of South Florida. Instead of cashiering or waitressing, she's worked as one of the state park's 20 mermaids for the past 3 years. She says it's a child's dream come true.
So I saw the show for the very first time when I was 6 years old, and I just fell in love with it. Ever since then, I told my parents, I'm going to be a mermaid when I grow up.
The 21-year-old performs in several shows a week, including one based on Hans Christian Andersen's version of The Little Mermaid. While she performs underwater in the spring, the audience is submerged in a 450-seat auditorium. John Athanason is with Weekiwachee Springs State Park. He says the auditorium was built in the 1950s and that it's the only one like it in Florida.
When people come see the mermaids perform, they're not in a tank. They're not in an aquarium. They are in a natural setting. In fact, our guests are the ones that are in a tank.
The mermaids perform a choreographed routine, swimming through the water with fabric fins and no weights to keep them in place. They stay underwater for the whole show, only pausing to take a breath of air from long rubber tubes floating around the spring. A narrator theatrically recites the story of a mermaid falling in love with a human prince, the sea witch who cursed her, and a clash between good and evil.
They dwell a strange and wondrous race of people, half human, half fish.
After the show, mermaids who didn't perform sit in a shaded alcove to visit and take pictures with guests. Hannah and Abby Hirschenreiter are here from Knoxville, Tennessee to visit them.
Okay, ready? Look, Hannah, 1, 2, 3. Oh, boy. Is there anything you
want to
ask her?
How did you get out here?
How did I get out here? Well, we have a potion that we drink, and it gives us legs. So I drank a potion when I got out of the water, and then I walked up here. But after a while, the potion wears off, and then I get my tail out.
Hannah's sister Abby was quick to say how much she enjoyed the show.
I liked it.
What'd you like about the mermaids?
All of it.
Their mother, Jenny Hirschenreiter, says while they came to Florida to visit her parents, visiting the mermaid show was a must.
Growing up, I always wanted to be a mermaid. And I think these little girls, I know they like to put on mermaid shows when they're swimming, so I think it was great. They were so excited to be here.
John Athanason says guests like Hirschenreiter, who visited the springs herself as a child, come back to the nearly 70-year-old attraction to relive fond memories.
This predates Disney, Universal. So back in the late 40s, 50s, and even through the 60s, when visitors came to Florida, they came to places like Weekiwachee Springs, Silver Springs, Cypress Gardens. So that nostalgia still remains to this day.
Back at the auditorium, mermaid Taylor Kane shares the secret to portraying the mythological sea creature.
24-hour lipsticks. Those were the only thing that stays on in the water. That's it. So, yep, that's the mermaid secret.
When the mermaids aren't at the park, they're visiting local aquariums to swim in the tanks alongside sharks, sea urchins, and fish, and participate in educational programs. That's what inspired Kane to change her college major from nursing to marine science.
Just going to the different aquariums and stuff, you know, interacting with the animals and talking to a lot of the biologists there, I just became really interested and I love it.
This mermaid wants to study sharks and dispel myths about real sea creatures. For Florida Matters, I'm Daylena Miller.
Coming up,
after a feeding session at the otter cage, it's time to go on safari.
We'll bring you more of Florida's roadside attractions, old and new. I'm Robin Sessingham. This is Florida Matters. This is Florida Matters. I'm Robin Sessingham, and we're talking about Florida's roadside attractions. The Dixie Highway that meandered through Polk County in the early 20th century inspired the creation of lots of roadside attractions along its path. Most are gone now, but their memories are kept alive at the Polk County History Center in Bartow, where I spoke with curator Maria Tripp about Polk's lost roadside attractions.
Masterpiece Gardens was in Lake Wales, and it opened in the 50s, and it was a mosaic that came from World War II Germany. And that was basically the entire attraction. Was once an hour, the curtain would open, and you could see this mosaic tile artwork of the Last Supper.
And did they got business?
Yes. And then as time went on and attractions started to pop up more and more, they tried to expand by having some animals and some rides. But when Disney came, it sort of killed all the roadside attractions.
What am I listening to? Was it just the...
Oh, these are actual pictures of some of these lost attractions.
Okay.
Like that's Sand Mountain.
What's Sand Mountain?
Apparently one of the byproducts of phosphate mining that you could not use for anything was accumulated into a huge pile of sand in Fort Meade, and people would ski down it. And at one point, Dick Pope, who owned Cypress Gardens, his son actually had the World Sand Skiing Group come to Sand Mountain and do a competition there.
How long was that around?
It opened in the late 40s, and it closed in the 60s. And like I say, in the 60s, phosphate technology allowed them to actually get something valuable out of that sand where they couldn't before. So the sand got used, and eventually the hill went away.
But people would come visit that?
It was very much a tourist attraction. The picture in our exhibit is actually the World Ski Competition, but people would come, locals, and just go down in garbage cans, on rafts, just anything you could slide down a sand mountain with. And that was in Fort Meade, which is just south of here.
What was the weirdest, do you think?
I would have to say the weirdest one would be probably a tie between Bartow's Phosphate Valley Exposition, which was nothing more than a little bit about the phosphate process and a giant concrete representation of a woolly mammoth fighting a saber-toothed tiger at the entrance. So it was just pretty much an attraction made out of animated dioramas.
That was in Mulberry.
That was in Bartow.
Or Bartow.
Actually on Highway 60, so just east of where we are right now.
1961 to 1973.
And I remember going there as a very little girl, and then tied with that was the Mystery House, which I don't remember that. That was before my time, and it was just a house that was built at a weird angle, and they would market it that a mysterious force had pulled the house and that you couldn't stand up straight in it. So basically the whole attraction was a crooked house.
Sunken Gardens is a lush, colorful, and fragrant tropical oasis in the middle of St. Petersburg. It was one of Florida's original roadside attractions. Florida Matters' Lisa Peeks walked through it with the garden's supervisor.
My name is Bill O'Grady, and I'm the supervisor of Sunken Gardens, and I began work here in the year 2000. The property was originally purchased in 1903 by George Turner. And it has a very unique geological feature, that being that it was an ancient sinkhole. So down in the bottom, there is rich black muck that probably accumulated over thousands of years. And that rich black muck is about 10 feet deep. So things grow extraordinarily quickly.
So he was just a guy that liked to grow things?
When George first came here, he planted seeds. And this is an example of one of the royal palms that George Turner planted from seed in 1903. And they are believed to be the oldest and the largest in Pinellas County. They top out at over 70 feet in height. By trade, he was a plumber. He loved horticulture. So he planted unusual plants such as these royal palms and rose bushes and everything. And it was set up as a nursery. From the nursery, it just suddenly turned into a roadside attraction, really. Many people came here because the Turner family advertised way up into the Carolinas and well up into the Midwest, and they had big billboards that said, come to Sunken Gardens, come to the Sunshine City. And people would come and visit, and then they would stay. And now their children and grandchildren live here.
It is amazing. We're right in the middle of a major metropolis.
Yes.
Can you describe the air just walking through at every turn? It's just perfume.
Yes, it's true. The Turner family had a lot of gardenias and things like that around. So in the last few years, we've made sure to replace some of them. We have put in sweet almond. is a very large angel's trumpet right over there. And so all of those things are extremely fragrant. In addition to that, I just think it has that smell of a jungle. It's very, very lush and green. And the water, of course, the moving water gives off negative ions. It's very relaxing. And even though we have the fragrances that are very intoxicating fragrances, just the smell of the rich black earth is a great experience for our senses.
Now, what is this?
These are our flock of flamingos. 59 and 53 were named by the community, George and Lucy, and they are the last of a flock of 17 that came to Sunken Gardens in 1956. Unfortunately, nothing lives forever, so they are certainly beginning to age out. With that in mind, we felt that it was incumbent upon us to restock the flock. Their diet, you can see over here the different bowls. But what they are a commercial flamingo chow, which is standard in zoos.
I can't believe that there is a commercial flamingo chow.
That's what I thought. But as it turns out, there are actually multiple flamingo chows. In the wild, typically they would be eating a lot of blue-green algae, and that's what usually gives them the color. Many people think that it's brine shrimp or any kind of shrimp that's in their diet. It's the carotenoids, the beta-carotene that's in the blue-green algae that really gives them their coloration.
A lot of people think that Florida is full of flamingos.
A lot of people do think that, and that is not the case. They haven't been found in Florida in the wild for a very long time. The only ones that are all over the place are plastic ones that are on people's lawns. The family kept the garden for three generations, and then in the 60s, they started adding a lot more birds. The flamingos had already been a hit, and ultimately they had things like capybara, which are the largest rodents in the world, African pygmy goats, and they had wallabies, and they had really an awful lot of animals. But by the time the 70s came, competition came with it. And so suddenly you start having the major attractions, such as Busch Gardens and Disney World and places like that, and there was a greater expectation from visitors. And while the interstates had lots of good benefits, the things that were previously roadside attractions were no longer roadside. They were off the beaten path. And so that certainly had an effect. But I think people no longer really were happy just to walk around in a beautiful tropical garden. They wanted the loud rides and all that scary business. And it just kind of was a beginning of a death knell, really, for the roadside attractions.
The story of Florida's tourist attractions includes a newer one. It's a place in the Tampa Bay area where you can get up close and personal with giraffes, camels, and zebras, but you won't find billboards for it or see it advertised on TV. Florida Matters' Mark Hayes says it's one of the most fun places in the region to visit and also one of its best-kept secrets. Mark Hayes brings us this story of the Giraffe Ranch.
The Giraffe Ranch sits at the end of a lonely dirt road in the northeast corner of Pasco County. It's not a zoo. It's a working game farm specializing in breeding African hooved animals for their own and other parks. Husband and wife Lex Salisbury and Elena Sheppa live on the property and have been allowing the public to visit since 2010. Salisbury is the former executive director of Tampa's Lowry Park Zoo. Sheppa says while the giraffes are the main attraction, they're just one of 70 species on display.
We have camels here. We have some really interesting heritage cattle. We love pigs. We have a variety of species of pigs. It's like going on safari in Africa.
Today, I'll join a tour group from the Monarch Learning Academy in Winter Park. They've been brought here by third grade teacher Beth Buchanan.
We came about 2 or 3 years ago with some other kids, and so we decided to come back. I think it's a great environment for the kids to learn about different animals and see them in a natural, more natural environment than a zoo. And the kids love the experience of actually getting to interact with them in the feedings.
First stop, the lemur cage, where kids are given grapes and instructions on how to feed the lemurs.
Okay, now guys, I'm a lemur. Show me how you're going to feed me. Perfect. You're hired. No. Watch how this is done so you can do it right. Perfect. You're hired. Now remember, these are dollar bills. Don't give up the wallet, right? Just peel these off. These are dollar bills. Here you go.
They're all attacking me. They're all attacking me.
Oh my gosh, look at the ones that surround
me. No one's going to drill on you.
Third grader Sagan Helms.
It's really cool how you get to feed them because they come. You go up and they take it right out of your hand.
After a feeding session at the otter cage, it's time to go on safari. we travel in what looks like a full-sized school bus, but with no roof or sides. The kids will see ostriches, rhinos, hippos, camels, and zebras, which amaze and excite them. But it's nothing compared to the reaction when the kids see the giraffes for the first time.
Giraffes! Oh!
That's cool. They look so beautiful and pretty.
Salisbury and Sheppa provide a supply of cabbage to offer the giraffes, who lean over and take it right from their hands.
But it's not that slobbery, like a dog tongue.
It looks slobbery.
It looks slobbery, but it's not.
But eat!
Oh my gosh.
Drool on it.
It's so gentle. Really? Oh my gosh, it feels like...
Oh my gosh, it feels like
a cat's tongue. Like
next up, the zebras. Salisbury answers the kids' questions, including one about a unique-looking animal mingling with the zebras.
What's the black skin, like, far away?
That's a zee-donk.
Is that a zebra slash?
Yeah, we got a trio of Sicilian donkeys from Miami Metro Zoo in here, and we never thought they'd breed these zebra because they're half the size, but this one male, this Jack... He had these two little Jennies, and he turned his back on them and fell in love with that zebra right there. Look at her. She's very pretty, isn't she? Anyway, he was smitten with her, and he followed her around for 4 years, and he finally got her in the ditch over there, and we have a zee-donk now.
While the kids enjoy lunch, I ask Salisbury why this place isn't better known.
It's all pretty much word of mouth, and we limit the numbers of people that come here. We get a lot of international visitors. You know, my wife and I live here, and we pay for all this, so we don't have money to do a lot of advertising.
At the end of the tour, Salisbury looks over the school group and reflects back to when he was their age.
When I was the age of these kids, I remember a great horned owl being brought into my classroom, and I still remember it. It's just burned into my brain. So what these guys just did today, they will remember when they're almost 60 like me.
Some things to keep in mind if you're considering a visit. Plan on spending half a day. Safaris start at $75 to ride the bus. If you'd rather ride a camel or llama, it will cost more. Feeding the giraffes is included in that price. Feeding the lemurs and otters costs extra. Space is severely limited, so you'll want to lock in your time and date as soon as you can. Bring a hat, water, sunscreen, and perhaps most importantly, a camera. I'm Mark Hayes for Florida Matters.
Thanks for joining us for a visit to Florida's roadside attractions. You can join the conversation on our Facebook page, or you can send an email to floridamatters@wusf.org. Florida Matters was produced by Susan Giles Wantuck and is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.